From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Do not come here now. That's President Biden's message to would-be migrants as numbers at the U.S. border with Mexico surge.
I can say quite clearly, don't come. And what we're in the process of getting set up, and it's not going to take a whole long time, is to be able to apply for asylum in place. So don't leave your town or city or community.
The president was speaking last night on ABC News. Earlier this week, a group of Republican lawmakers visited El Paso and said President Biden is to blame for the surge of unaccompanied children crowded into Border Patrol facilities. Joining us now is Mike Howell, senior advisor at the Heritage Foundation and former counsel at Homeland Security under President Trump. Mike, welcome. On his visit to El Paso, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy said what's happening is heartbreaking, and he says it's President Biden's fault. Do you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. It surely has. I mean, through the undoing of all the successful Trump administration's actions, and you coupled that with the messaging loud and clear that has created the impression south of the border that basically we're open for business, the business of illegal immigration.
All right. Well, you say that it's Biden's fault, but that is not what Congresswoman Veronica Escobar told NPR this morning. She's a Democrat from Texas, and she says that the Border Patrol told her that more families have been coming to the border from the Northern Triangle, countries like Guatemala and Honduras, for the past year or so. Let's listen.
If folks in the Northern Triangle knew back in April that Joe Biden was not only going to be the nominee, but that he was going to be president, that's pretty incredible.
Yeah, we checked the numbers, and they seem to check out. According to the Pew Research Center, this is the 10th consecutive month of increased apprehensions. February was higher than typical months, but the highest in recent years was back in April of 2019. So how's that Joe Biden's fault?
So Representative Escobar is right that there has been an increase since about April last year. But what she doesn't note is that there traditionally are increases in these summer months for the seasonality. When they kind of taper down is when it either gets too hot or too cold. So what we're seeing right now in February and since November in this drastic spike up is unusual. But she's also right to note that the impressions of migrants south of the border are impacted by the U.S. political conditions. There was a lot of folks who are pushing these illegal migration channels that were basically saying, get in before Biden's president, because that's going to be the amnesty cutoff date.
Conservatives are saying the border is open. It's not really. You say the policies have been loosened. Some of them have, but some of them have not. Biden has kept the Trump pandemic order in place. That means that individual migrants are still turned away at the border. In most cases, it's still turning away families. It's just the unaccompanied minors that are being allowed into the country. So I'm not sure that argument follows, does it?
So the big one you mentioned is what's called Title 42. That's using the pandemic as a public health justification to turn away folks. President Trump was applying that across the board. President Biden is now not applying it to unaccompanied children. So that's why we're seeing the spike in kind of UACs, unaccompanied children, arriving. But even with Title 42 being applied to individuals and families, it's still a numbers game. You have CBP overwhelmed. You know, some days 6,000 people showing up that they have to deal with. That's only the people that they catch.
On the issue of taking kids into the country, isn't that the humane thing to do? Otherwise, they're just going to be sent back into a very dangerous situation on the other side of the border if they're turned away.
No, there's nothing humane about being on the receiving end in the final act in a child trafficking network. These kids are abused terribly, sexually, physically, all sorts, mentally along the journey.
Isn't that the point to get them out of that situation and into federal custody?
This situation markedly occurs on the journey to the U.S. when they are in the custody of the traffickers.
The Trump administration sort of made a name for itself because of the conditions that it put children in at the border by separating them from their families. So again, how do you make that argument?
You're talking about the conditions when they were received by CBP. I think those facilities were not represented accurately in the media whatsoever. Trump administration has a better record on this than the Biden administration. The Biden administration's goal here is massive amounts of throughput.
There's an argument to be made that it's not Biden's fault because of the economic conditions of the migrants in the home countries. Three back-to-back hurricanes in Honduras since October, gang violence, drug cartels, climate change wreaking havoc on farms that push people north. Do you agree with the idea that the United States can help stem the flow of migrants if we send money to those countries to help improve conditions there?
No, absolutely not. The best thing we can do is to stop taking their, you know, best, brightest, and hardest working.
Mike Howell, senior advisor at the Heritage Foundation and former counsel at Homeland Security under President Trump. Thanks for your time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We're taking a closer look now at the environmental impact of fracking for oil and gas. Fracking creates an enormous amount of wastewater. In Pennsylvania, 90% of fracking wastewater is reused, but the rest is pumped underground for disposal. That's more than 200 million gallons a year. Most of it's trucked to what are called injection wells in Ohio. And as the number of injection wells there continues to grow, so does the concern. Julie Grant of the Allegheny Front reports.
After 25 years in their Belmont County, Ohio home, Judy Berger's husband is getting ready to retire. But their mostly peaceful half acre is quickly changing.
I'm a nervous wreck. I have my Venetian blinds closed in my house so I don't have to look across the street to see the mayhem and the destruction and the coming reality.
That reality? Across the street, Omni Energy of New Jersey is drilling two frack waste injection wells. This is Sound Berger reported of the construction. Once it's done, wastewater from oil and gas operations in Ohio, West Virginia, and Pennsylvania will be trucked here. According to an Ohio transportation study, 48 trucks will enter and exit the site during peak morning and afternoon hours to inject waste into the wells, waste that the U.S. EPA says can be toxic and radioactive. Berger does not want to live here anymore.
It's beyond description how horrible it is to feel like you're stuck. We were told we have no property value. Nobody would buy our property.
Berger wants it clear. She is not an environmentalist. She voted for the past two Republican governors, but she blames them for supporting industry over local communities.
And why the state favors somebody who comes in here from out of state over its own citizens? You know, that's what's happening.
For years, many Republican leaders in southeastern Ohio have lined up to support the oil and gas industry. They've seen some residents make good money from land leases and royalties and find good-paying jobs. But like Judy Berger, some of those same leaders are flummoxed by the lack of local control in siting the Omni injection wells and two others nearby by another company.
We've got the township trustees don't want it. We've got the county commissioners don't want it. We've got the state rep don't want it. We've got the locals that don't want it.
Republican State Senator Frank Hoagland represents the area. He says he's gone directly to the Ohio Department of Natural Resources, which has regulatory authority over the oil and gas industry, to oppose the wells.
And I said, so you got everybody saying no, but you guys are going to authorize it anyways. And the director flat out said, if it fits within the ORC, we have to allow it to happen. We have to give them the permit.
The ORC, he mentioned, is the Ohio Revised Code, which spells out the regulations for injection wells. The Department of Natural Resources did not respond to requests for an interview. As the state considered Omni's injection well application, local residents wrote letters with concerns about truck traffic and idling, about noise and the proximity to homes and schools. When the pandemic hit, the ODNR attempted to delay a decision until it could hold a public hearing in person. But Omni sued to force a permit decision, and the Ohio Supreme Court sided with Omni. The permit was approved last year. This drilling sound will subside once construction is complete, according to Chris Gagan, attorney for the company. He says even during the drilling phase, it isn't much louder than the nearby highway. He says the wells will prevent groundwater contamination and surface leaks. Ed Maurer, manager of the Energy Institute at nearby Belmont College, says the energy industry has brought a lot to the county already.
The 11 new hotels, the 1,400 new hotel rooms, all the employment.
He points out that injection wells are a necessary part of energy development. The waste it produces has to go someplace.
Disposal wells are a fact of the oil and gas industry.
But nearly half the waste injected in Ohio disposal wells comes from out of state, according to a 2017 report, mostly from Pennsylvania. Ted Auk is with the nonprofit Frack Tracker Alliance.
So somewhere there was a decoupling of what's generated in Ohio and what Ohio is disposing of, which means that we are more and more taking in a higher percentage of other people's stuff.
According to the ODNR, Ohio has 226 wells injecting frack waste. Pennsylvania has 9, according to the U.S. EPA, which regulates injection wells in Pennsylvania. Ohio has what's called primacy to regulate injection wells. In 1983, decades before the modern shale industry, the federal government granted the state authority. Auk and others concerned about injection wells want a reconsideration of Ohio's primacy.
Primacy is something that's a special thing. You should have to demonstrate all the time that you're worthy of that as a state. And the state of Ohio has not done that.
But in 2015, the U.S. EPA found that Ohio was running a, quote, good quality program, praising the agency for dealing with the potential for earthquakes caused by injection wells, while still recommending stronger enforcement for repeat violations. Senator Hoagland does not want Ohio to give up its authority over injection wells to the federal government.
I'd much rather say, hey, look, if we've got the local leadership saying, hell no, we don't want this, well, to me, that should be good enough.
Hoagland says the Ohio Department of Natural Resources could do more to work with local communities and energy developers on siting decisions. He and other local leaders are looking at ways to change state law to encourage that. For Here and Now, I'm Julie Grant.
If you missed Sunday night's Grammy Awards, the Recording Academy is back with a two-hour program tonight called A Grammy Salute to the Sounds of Change. It'll feature a number of artists showcasing songs that inspired social justice and equality. Presenters are also expected to reflect on some of the most iconic moments in Grammy history. But we're still reflecting on the iconic moments from this year's Grammys and what they tell us about the time we're in. Let's discuss with Jenna Wortham. She's staff writer for the New York Times Magazine and co-host of the podcast Still Processing, and Evie Ani, cultural critic and editor-in-chief of Amaka Studio. Welcome to you both.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me, too. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. And we got to start with the performance that people are still talking about. Let's listen. Really ain't never got a mark for a thing. He already made his mind up, boy. Can't not get your boots, hang your coat, but it's wet. Keep out a bone. Megan Thee Stallion and Cardi B gave a very, very provocative performance of their single WAP. There's been a lot of talk, even among our own staff, about whether that was inappropriate for primetime network TV or an empowering performance by two strong women. Evie, I'm going to start with you. What do you say?
I think it's just surprising that people are still talking about this. I thought we'd progressed past this sort of conversation, but it seems like the discourse is kind of cyclical because there's been so many moments within hip hop where people have talked about sex and have been provocative politically, sexually. But for some reason, conservatives are very upset with Cardi B and Megan Thee Stallion, and people who don't identify as conservative are still questioning this performance, like you said, and whether it has a place on primetime television, what this means if children are watching the Grammys, if the Grammys is still a family show. But I think there's a demographic of people who are kind of desensitized to this type of imagery. But I think it's just a testament to the fact that anytime Black women express themselves in any capacity, especially in a sexual manner, especially within hip hop or music in general, there always will be that level of criticism, questionings, concerns, and everything in between.
Yeah. Well, Jenna, what do you think? Because even before this performance at the Grammys, you wrote an essay about WAP for the New York Times Magazine. The headline called it a celebration of sex in a year of deprivation. And you wrote that men whined in interviews about its moral bankruptcy, nothing more than thinly veiled respectability politics meant to police Black women's sexual appetites. Sounds like you may be saying some of what Evie is saying there.
Yes, I agree with Evie completely. I mean, I'll also say that we've come such a long way. I mean, if you remember in 2004, over a decade ago, after Janet Jackson was embarrassed on national television because of Justin Timberlake and took all the heat from that, you know, interaction and that exchange, she was banned from the Grammys because people were so worried that she was going to scandalize young minds. And, you know, it's wild that we're still here. But, you know, frankly, the Grammys need Cardi B and Meg more than they need them. I mean, you know, Cardi B also said she didn't submit WAP for consideration, that she decided to wait for her own album. So she was not counting on
next
that
year,
institution.
Right.
Right, at all for validation or recognition. So, you know, I'm sure they approached her. I'm sure they knew exactly what they were going to get. Cardi B and Meg don't tone it down for anybody. And, you know, they were lucky to have that performance because otherwise it probably would have been a really dry evening, pun intended. And I think, you know, that's to be expected. I mean, we're honestly lucky to have them.
Well, let's turn to another notable moment. EVA singer and songwriter Her won Song of the Year for her song I Can't Breathe. Her told People magazine that this song is dedicated to George Floyd and all the protesters that worked so hard to fight for social justice. EVA, what does it say to you that this song won?
It seems like the Grammys is sort of making a vested effort in listening to the public concerns that kind of get expressed every single year as it pertains to how the Grammys treats Black artists, as it pertains to the Grammys as an institution. Regardless, at the end of the day, the Grammy still has very material and tangible influence on Black artists' lives and careers, and in the way that history is documented, in the way that music history is documented. So when they give out these awards, that kind of gets pushed to the wayside, whether the intent is sincere or not, because in the end, this is how it's going to be documented. And for a song like that to win says a lot.
Yeah, and to that point, long-running trend continued on Sunday when Billie Eilish won Record of the Year for the second straight time, and during her acceptance speech she said that she was embarrassed that she won instead of Meg Thee Stallion. Let's listen to Billie Eilish.
I was gonna write a speech about how you deserve this, but then I was like, there's no way they're gonna choose me. I was like, it's hers.
Which, Jenna, I'm sure reminds you of 2017 when Adele won Album of the Year instead of Beyonce, and then she gave this speech.
I can't possibly accept this award, and I'm very humbled and I'm very grateful and gracious, but my artist of my life is Beyonce, and this album for me, the Lemonade album, was just so monumental, Beyonce, it was so monumental.
Jenna, this has happened other times as well. How did this moment with Billie Eilish go over for you, and why does this keep happening?
I don't know. I'm still thinking about it, to be honest with you, because I'm not sure what Billie Eilish was thinking, you know, and it did feel really performative, right? Like when Adele gets up there and talks about Beyonce, it felt like Adele was vocalizing a sentiment shared by so many people. And Adele, it was so clumsy. Yes, it was so ham-handed, but also you could see that Adele really looked up to her. And so I think, you know, we also saw this happen when Macklemore posted a screenshot of the text he sent to Kendrick Lamar. I mean, I just feel like white artists are doing this performative thing where they're embarrassed about their own successes and they're embarrassed about the ways the awards institutions generally choose them and, you know, the hierarchy
that they tend
to enjoy.
Well, what should she have done, do you think?
Listen, I don't know. I've never been in that position, and I will never be in the position of winning a Grammy and thinking someone else should have it. But I do think these artists need to consider, you know, the institution that they're a part of and why they feel that way. And what does it mean that they keep winning these awards over these Black women, you know, and these Black artists in general, and to think about reframing that apology as a criticism of the institution.
Very interesting. And related to all of this is Lil Baby's performance of his song, The Big Picture, which theatrically depicted police brutality. And it also featured the activist Tamika Mallory. Let's listen.
My people, it's time we stand. It's time we demand the freedom that this land promises. President Biden, we demand justice, equity, policy, and everything else that freedom encompasses.
Now, this is where it gets interesting because Samaria Rice, the mother of Tamir Rice, of course, the boy who was killed by Cleveland police in 2014, criticized Mallory and the performance. She said that, quote, we never hired them to be representatives in the fight for justice for our dead loved ones murdered by police. She said it felt exploitative to her. And before that, Lil Baby said he wanted the performance to, quote, reflect the real. But Jenna, what do you think? Was it appropriate or did it cross the line?
You know, I'm still thinking about what EVA said a moment ago, which I just wholeheartedly agree with, you know, that these awards provide such a spotlight, and what people choose to do with them really matters. And the audience can tell when it feels performative, and the audience can tell when it feels, you know, advantageous. And it's a very thin line between protest and performance, right? And I think that in this case, it unfortunately did not feel honest. It did not feel genuine. And at the end of the day, you know, we have to respect the families and we have to respect the mothers of these children, you know, and what they feel and what they want has, you know, very little to do with our desires to benefit and commodify the very real pain and the very real suffering that they are going through. And it really just speaks to a desire that artists and organizers, they have to work with the community because that's what matters. Like, they have to feel like people are working with them and for them. And if they don't, then all is lost.
Evie, I'm going to give you the last word. There's no doubt, just having this conversation, that music is a barometer of our culture and where it stands in a certain moment. And I just wonder what your take is overall on how the Grammys reflected that moment last weekend. And do you think the awards are changing fast enough to keep up?
I mean, it just feels like there have been so many cultural and social factors that have kind of converged to bring us to this moment in which the bottom of celebrity activism is falling out and people are able to spot it. And so much has been conflated as it pertains to sort of activism, symbolic activism, marketing, mm-hmm. and the corporate structures mm-hmm. that kind of want to keep these problems in place so that there's something to sell to us. And that criticism of people sort of banking on Black death to keep this machine running is a very real criticism. And I think that the Grammys cannot remove itself from that framework. And it seems like it's been taking a while for the Grammys to catch on, but it seems like they're also making an effort. But again, it's hard to gauge whether that's a sincere effort or whether that's an effort that's vested in this idea that we need to keep this machine running so that there's always a problem that needs to be addressed in a heartfelt, sympathetic way that can pull at the heartstrings of audiences and get them to trust an institution like the Grammys and get them to watch the Grammys to see if they're going to address any social issues. It's really this sort of cycle that we can't seem to get out of.
Mm-hmm. What a thought-provoking night. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us about it. Evie Ani is a cultural critic and editor-in-chief of Amaka Studio, and Jenna Wortham, staff writer for the New York Times Magazine and co-host of the podcast Still Processing, out with a new season tomorrow, by the way. Really, thanks to you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
On NPR's Consider This podcast, we don't just help you keep up with the news, we help you make sense of what's happening. Like what the case about George Floyd's killing means for the ongoing fight for racial justice, or how to best navigate a pandemic that's changed life for all of us. All of that in 15 minutes every weekday. Listen now to Consider This from NPR.
It's St. Patrick's Day, and the Guinness is not flowing in pubs in Ireland. The country's in a coronavirus lockdown. In the town of Carseveen in County Kerry, there are 1,500 people in 14 pubs. One of them has been there since the mid-1800s, Mike Mertz. Its owner is the fourth-generation Mike Mert to run the place. It's a traditional pub with a concrete floor, two fireplaces, timber ceilings, and the highlight?
It's an old timber bar. There's a lower part of the bar and then there's a higher part where you serve the drinks. It's aged well.
When's the last time you served a drink at the pub?
The last time I served a drink, I'd say it was the middle of October, about the 15th or 16th of October.
So how are you making ends meet? I mean, there is, when we think of it, like in a pub, especially a pub like yours, it's cheek by jowl. I know this because I was there once several years ago, and there's not a lot of room, so there's no social distancing.
Yeah, we did it for the summer, and everyone had to sit down, and it was doable. Sometimes interesting, but doable.
When you say sometimes interesting, what do you mean?
When people got a bit inebriated, they might just go over, talking to each other and forget about the social distancing.
So if that's not happening anymore, I imagine that things are difficult financially. I know you're planning on opening again, right?
Yeah. Well, we get the payment every week of €350 from the government.
What about all the people who are regulars there, who come by, who live, I'm not talking about the tourists, but those who come by and want a quick pop or to listen to some music? Where do they go?
It's hard on a lot of people. We'd be kind of a country pub in the town. And there's a lot of people, like there's farmers, mostly farmers, that they live in their own and they like to get into town, but there's nothing to come into. It's very hard on them. The pub is their outlet. After 6 o'clock in the evening, you don't see anyone at all in town.
And what about you? I mean, this is not just your livelihood. It's been the livelihood of three generations previous to you. What's it like to try and maintain the family business, which is really popular in town, and not even be able to open for so long?
It's a worry of what will happen after when we do open, because a lot of people are saying they haven't drank for a long time and they get used to not coming to town, and what will happen? I don't know. You just don't know what will happen when you open the door. But we'll have to try anyway.
What do you miss most, Mike?
I miss having a few drinks with the customers late at night, and I enjoy the job. It's 90% fun and 10% hard work.
Well, I hope you get back to 100% very soon. And Mike, I'm going to ask you, what song, if we were to end this with a song other than When Irish Eyes Are Smiling, what song would you like us to end this with?
What song? A Nation Once Again.
Why did you say that?
I don't know, just to stand tall again as a nation, and hopefully we'll come out of this and be as good as we were before us.
Mike Murray, thank you so much. Really nice to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
Mike Murt, just waiting to open the doors and have a drink with his customers at Mike Murt's pub in Carseveen, County Kerry, Ireland. When my dear country shall be made a nation once again, a nation once again, a nation once again.
Is that light we see at the end of the runway? The TSA has reported more than 1 million travelers have passed through airport security checkpoints each day for nearly a week. The CDC still advises against travel, but with vaccines rolling out, many people appear unwilling to wait. Let's bring in Seth Kaplan. He's Here and Now's transportation analyst. And Seth, how would you describe what it's like at airports right now?
For most of the pandemic, Peter, the busiest day of the pandemic has been far less busy than the least busy day before the pandemic. So in other words, the day before Thanksgiving, typically a very heavy travel day. This past year, less busy than Thanksgiving Day itself most years, which is a very light travel day. We're coming up on a couple of milestones here in terms of turning the corner. One, just kind of eyeballing the numbers, I would say today might end up being the first day, very likely the first day, that will be busier than the same day a year ago. St. Paddy's Day of a year ago is the first day under 1 million, and today is likely to be over 1 million. And then someday soon, we're going to have that first day where it's going to be busier than really a pre-pandemic day, even before everything was affected early last March.
I see. Well, we've seen holiday bumps in travel before around Christmas and Thanksgiving, but that's when the pandemic was at its worst. Now, of course, it's spring break time. Do you think there are signs that this growth could be different?
No question. And it starts just with those numbers, right? In the past, it was all couched in relative terms, right? As I said, a holiday travel period, sure, it might have been busier than a non-holiday travel period during the pandemic, but still very, very quiet. Now you're starting to see demand pick up, maybe not to pre-pandemic levels overall, but clearly nothing like what we've seen for most of the past year. For better or worse, as you mentioned, health authorities continue advising against non-essential travel, but people, as they get vaccinated especially, seem more comfortable making plans. And this time booking plans, not just thinking about the refund they could get, but plans that they might actually be able to keep.
Yeah. Is it safe to be on a plane yet? What do the data say?
Well, the data all along, to the extent that we have any, and Peter, this is one of those cases where you only know what you know, right? Not a lot of confirmed cases of people spreading the virus on the airplane. But again, that doesn't mean that that hasn't happened. Just not a lot of confirmation of that. No evidence, though, that it's more dangerous sitting close to somebody on an airplane than it is sitting close to somebody anywhere else. It's just that you're in a room full of a whole lot of people, and that's been the case all along. So airplane air, not dirtier than any other air. We're just supposed to be 6 feet away from other people wearing a mask, and on an airplane, typically you aren't.
Hmm. Seth Kaplan, Here and Now's transportation analyst. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter.
Well, as Seth was just telling us, many people are already vacationing, but if you're like me, you're still daydreaming about your next trip outside the living room. And maybe you're wondering, is it possible to do it safely, or am I even allowed to go where I want to? Elizabeth Blount McCormick is here to answer your travel questions. She is the president of Uniglobe Travel Designers. It's a woman-owned full-service travel company, and she's on Skype. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Glad to have you. And look, we need to get this elephant in the room out of the way right away. The CDC still says we should avoid travel unless absolutely necessary, even if we're fully vaccinated. So what are you telling people about whether they should be traveling or not?
There are a couple things you have to consider. Is everyone in your immediate bubble, are they vaccinated, or are they immunocompromised? So what I'm saying to people is that there are so many resorts, in the U.S. and then obviously, in the Caribbean and Mexico, where they're actually conducting COVID testing on site. You have to take a COVID test and provide a negative result before you travel and fly to many places. And so what we've been doing is just, of course, when people reach out to us, is checking with these resorts, checking with the locations to really understand what would the experience look like so the client will feel comfortable.
So it is a risk, we'll say that, but
right?
People are doing it anyways. And so tell me, what has 2021 been like so far for you? I had mentioned earlier the number of airport screenings TSA is doing are way up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we, are a full service company, as you mentioned. And so we have corporate clients and then obviously the leisure vacation clients. And so I will tell you that on both ends, we're seeing an increase. We are seeing people that actually book travel for spring break that are still trying to book travel for spring break. Mm. We've received requests for villas where you could have a chef coming in a cleaning company, but where they are just, again, with their immediate family.
And where are people going? In other words, are the circumstances changing their calculations?
Well, it's interesting because, to be honest with you, we have not had many people ask about Europe. We did have a client last week. We booked their family of five to Greece. And then we've got clients that are looking at going to the West Coast. And we're also continuing to see requests for the Caribbean, for Costa Rica. And then, of course, I mentioned a lot of these locations have testing happening on site, so people feel more at ease because they know that there are strict protocols that are in place.
You said Greece, and I didn't hear anything you said after that because I'm just salivating. That's the one. That's the one I've been daydreaming about for so long, for so long.
The one thing I wanted to mention just quickly about Greece is that they're opening up the borders to people that have been vaccinated.
Well, it brings me to my next question, because before we got you on the line, we asked our listeners what kind of things they were wondering about in terms of travel, and we're going to go through a few of those now. Shantanu Gujar of Cary, North Carolina, wants to know if he needs to be fully vaccinated if he wants to travel outside of the United States, or would he just need to get a COVID test done? What would you tell him? I mean, it sounds like you're saying it kind of depends on where you want to go.
Yes. And I say to people, like, I would check if you're trying to travel internationally, you need to check with the State Department because things are changing on a case by case and day by day basis. I'd also just suggest consulting with a travel advisor because, we have access to all those relationships where we can physically call somebody at the resort, talk to someone. Is this open? What does it look like? But again, do not book any international travel until you read the COVID policy.
Countries like Israel have been rolling out vaccine passports. Those would allow vaccinated people to go to restaurants, gyms, malls, or to travel. From your perspective, are we going to be seeing more of those? Is that a good policy?
I think it is. Yes. For us to heal as a global society, we're going to all have to. I think we owe it to each other, to protect ourselves and protect each other.
We got another question from a listener in Boston, Patricia, who says she wants to know how to protect herself at airports and on flights, and if there is a time of day when flights are generally less crowded.
Okay. So, obviously socially distancing is still in place and wearing a mask and staying 6 feet apart at an airport, but also checking with the airline. There might be other testing documents that are required. So far, the only airline in the U.S. that is still extending the middle seat being blocked is Delta. So we have a number of clients that are confident with it and they feel better by flying Delta because they know they're still adhering to blocking the middle seat and not overbooking flights.
Does that concern you? I mean, I haven't been on an airplane in a year, and the middle seat is terrible even without a pandemic, but I would not feel comfortable in a middle seat. What do you think?
Yeah, I wouldn't either. I'm glad that they continue to block that. But the other question I just wanted to address, you were asking, like, when is there a time of day when flights are less crowded? And that's early afternoon. You want to fly out early in the morning, right? If you're going on vacation or to get somewhere, leaving that 6, 7, 8 o'clock time. But that early afternoon is where flights are less crowded and you won't find that many people at the airport.
Good to know. What about prices? What are they like right now? And will they start to shoot up again after all this stimulus money gets injected to the economy? And as people get vaccinated, demand for travel starts to pick up again.
I think as more schedules are added, the airlines have to make money. So I wouldn't expect people to think that we're going to pay $60 for a flight down to Miami. I don't see it happening because of supply and demand. And and same thing with hotels. But I would not predict that prices are going to be so low. Not at all.
All right. Well, we got to say, again, the CDC is warning against travel, even for fully vaccinated people. We do know that people get sick with COVID when they leave home. It is a risk. But the numbers are clear. People are leaving, whether they should or not. Elizabeth Blount McCormick, president of Uniglobe Travel Designers. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you again. I appreciate it.
A new report by U.S. intelligence agencies says Russian President Vladimir Putin directed efforts to try to swing last year's election in Donald Trump's favor. The report also concluded that China did not try to interfere. That runs counter to claims by the Trump campaign that China was trying to get Joe Biden elected. NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie joins us now for more. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Lisa.
So start off with Russia. What was the interference campaign Russia mounted last year, according to this report? And what did it do? Compare it to what it did when Trump was running against Hillary Clinton in 2016.
Yeah, sure. So the key element in the 2020 campaign, according to this report, is that Russia was using proxies, people who had ties to individuals in Trump's orbit. They cited a few examples, and I'll mention one here. They named Andrei Derkach. Now, he's a Ukrainian lawmaker who is accused of having ties to Russian intelligence. Now, we know he met with Rudy Giuliani, Trump's former lawyer. Giuliani is not mentioned in the report, but we do know just from public what we've seen publicly, both of these men were spreading these unsubstantiated claims that Biden and his son, Hunter Biden, were somehow involved in corruption in Ukraine. And so this the report is saying this is the kind of thing that Russia was up to. Now, it is a contrast to 2016. Back then, the Russians hacked Democratic Party emails and they waged this big social media campaign. The U.S. was very unprepared at that point, really caught off guard. So I think the U.S. was much more prepared, both from a national security standpoint and from the public's perspective as well. And this likely led the Russians to take a different approach last year.
So we should note that the report also says that while Russia did interfere, there's no indication that Russia or any country tried to actually alter votes or voter registrations. So what impact did the interference have?
Well, probably not much in terms of the mechanics of voting. Because this was a foreign intelligence report, they're not trying to look at the behavior of U.S. voters. But they are making the point very clearly that there was no evidence that a foreign country in any way manipulated voter rolls or actual voter counting. So if you take this in tandem with what we've heard from U.S. officials who said the election was secure and did not have any fraud, they really show that we had a pretty safe election. There's no evidence that the election was riddled with any sort of fraud.
The report also says that the leader of Iran authorized an influence campaign meant to undercut Donald Trump. What did Iran do?
So it says that the Iranian leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, authorized a campaign. Now, based on what we're seeing in the report, it doesn't appear to be huge. There was one incident last year that got some attention. There was this email that seemed to be turning up in Florida, and it was purported to be from the Proud Boys, the far-right group. And in this email, it was threatening Democratic voters and telling them to vote for Donald Trump. But U.S. intelligence officials really tracked this down almost immediately, and within a day or so, they sort of said what was behind this. The report does go on to say that the Iranians opted for some cyber efforts because they're low cost, they're deniable, they don't require access to the U.S. So it was worth noting, but it doesn't seem like this was something that had much of an impact.
And how about China? What did the report say about foreign threats from China to the election?
So there was a lot of concern about China during the campaign. President Trump was very critical of China, put a lot of sanctions on them. So there was the thinking that China might try to do something as a very skilled cyber player to try to undermine the Trump campaign. In fact, Trump himself and his supporters claimed this, but they didn't provide any evidence. And the intelligence community conclusion was that China chose not to run an influence campaign. The report said, and I'll quote briefly here, it said, China sought stability in its relationship with the U.S. and did not view either election outcome, meaning Trump or Biden, as being advantageous enough to risk getting caught meddling. So it seems they sat this one out.
So does it mean that the United States did a better job at upholding the integrity of American elections? It seems as though they were more ready than they were in 2016. They could perhaps predict more. Are they doing better in actuality?
So the short answer is yes. We did see a big improvement. I mean, one domestic agency, which doesn't get a lot of attention because it's new, is the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Agency, CISA, which is part of the Homeland Security. It was created in 2018. It did a lot of the monitoring, working with states domestically and abroad. The National Security Agency has taken a lot of efforts to try to not only detect but neutralize any efforts abroad. But this has become a permanent part of our elections. That was clear in this report. It's an easy thing. It's a cheap thing for foreign countries to do. And we just need to be ready to expect it in every election going forward.
All right. Thank you, NPR National Security Correspondent Greg Myrie. Thanks, Greg.
My pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.